Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Thursday, July 24th, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Law enforcement says in press conference family may never get answers about Brian Koberger's motivation in killing four people. Idaho conservation groups sue over Stibnite Mine air quality permit. And an interview with Pullman City Council Ward 3 candidate Colin Bannister. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. At a press conference following yesterday's sentencing of convicted quadruple murderer Brian Koberger to four consecutive life terms, Latah County Prosecutor Bill Thompson and various police leaders involved in the investigation tried to address questions about details in the case, which were under a gag order while Koberger's trial was pending. Thompson also addressed the decision to accept the plea deal from the defense that would allow Koberger to avoid the death penalty.
We realized that we had tough decisions to make, and we made them, but we did not make them in a vacuum. As I said in court today, we reached out to the families, we asked their thoughts, we listened to what they had to say. We accept and recognize that not everybody agrees with the decision we made, but this isn't a popularity contest. We made what we thought was the most appropriate decision under the law and on the facts to give this case closure in a sense that would never be realized otherwise. Judge Hipwood talked today about, I guess, the fallacy of expecting that there would be some miraculous coming clean of disclosure from the defendant. In the first instance, as the judge said, she doesn't have the power to compel that. We, the state, don't have the power to compel that. And as a practical matter, it would not be helpful. It would give him a forum to share whatever he thought to control the dialogue. Not going to happen to our victims. We can't allow that to happen.
That is Latah County Prosecutor Bill Thompson, FBI Salt Lake City Field Office Senior Supervisory Agent Brett Grover explained how his agency helped with the investigation that eventually led to Koberger's arrest on December 30th, 2022.
The FBI dedicated significant resources to include digital and forensic analysis, intelligence support from our folks at FBI headquarters and field offices around the country, and victim services, which continue to this day. Today's sentencing also demonstrates how the responsible use of investigative genetic genealogy, or IGG, can transform a crime scene into accountability and closure. The IGG process involves the use of DNA analysis combined with traditional genealogy research to generate investigative leads for unsolved violent crimes. In late 2022, IGG provided a crucial investigative direction for investigators working this case. But I want to be clear, IGG was just one tool that led us here today. It's a powerful complement to the core investigative work done by both the FBI and our partner agencies. The bottom line is that successful cases like this are about strong partnerships and a shared goal, the goal of keeping our communities safe and providing a measure of justice for the families of our victims. Thank you.
That was FBI Salt Lake City Field Office Senior Supervisory Agent Brett Grover. During questioning, reporters wanted to know details about the investigation. Investigators said Judge Hipler is working with law enforcement to release evidence in the case publicly, but they also have to protect the privacy of the family's victims and the identities of some of the witnesses. Here's some of the questions from reporters at yesterday's press conference.
There is no evidence that we found that would lead us to any specific, even general location as to where the murder weapon or the clothes have been. And we searched. I mean, we The FBI, again, to their credit, we had folks doing soil samples and so all sorts of things to try to come up with somewhere to start searching for these things, and we just never found it. As far as the forensics piece, I'll let Darren speak to
that. Yeah, and on the weapon, it wasn't a lack of trying. Yeah. You know, everywhere that we had evidence of where he went, based upon phone records, based upon the evidence that we had gathered, we searched that. We went there. We did searches on the ground, in the water. We did searches. We sent soil samples to try to figure out maybe where a shovel had been used. So we searched everywhere that we possibly could, but the reality is we're looking for a singular small, it's not that small, but K-bar knife, and that's it. So it's endless of where it could have been, and we just were not able to find it. So
what about the clothes and his ability to deploy forensics at the scene, in a murder scene where we now know Kay Wiggins' office was stabbed 34 times and another victim was stabbed more?
Right. So the reality is that somebody can carry this out and still not get covered in blood. That's the reality of it, and this does happen, and there's plenty of studies of that. And we've had some of the world's experts that we've asked those same questions, because we've struggled with that. Why do we not find more here and there? And the reality was, if somebody has the training, if somebody has thought about it, if somebody wears the right type of clothing, that could be the outcome, and that's what we were left with.
Good. Over here.
Gene Casares with CNN. Mr. Thompson, did you do psychological testing on Brian Hoberger? Did that weigh into your decision to have a plea deal? And stabbings, multiple stabbings, are very personal. How did you assess that mode of murder?
I can tell you that psychological testing was done with Mr. Hoberger. The results of that do not rise to a defense to his conduct under Idaho law. The results of the various testing, most of it done by the defense or on behalf of the defense, is also sealed by court order. So I can't speak to any specifics, but I can tell you, yes, psychological testing was done. I can also tell you that, no, psychological testing or any potential psychological condition, Mr. Hoberger, that did not play a role in our decision.
Bill, does it have any bearing on where he will be placed or housed?
Where Mr. Hoberger, where the defendant is going to be housed, is going to be up to the Idaho Department of Correction. And that could very well change over time. And the reality is we will know about it after it happens.
Over here.
Did you monitor Mr. Hoberger's communications while he was incarcerated? And did he say anything that was helpful or gave you any insight as to why he did this?
Yeah, we did monitor it, both while he was housed in Latah County and then once he was moved down to Ada County. We have hundreds, thousands of hours of monitoring that was done, but there was nothing of evidentiary value that was gained from any of it.
Will you be releasing those conversations?
That's a good question.
It's my understanding that the jail will not be releasing things that involve personal conversations with third parties. That ultimately would be a decision because the recordings are possession of the two correctional facilities or detention facilities. But I'm pretty certain the Latah County Sheriff's Office policy does not allow for that, and I would guess Ada County is similar. You can ask them.
Back here.
Thank you. Greg Fisher with CBS News 48 Hours. Was there any evidence that Hoberger was following the social media of any of the victims?
So, trust us, we wanted that to be the case. We've looked for a link, and we have not found one. Not one.
Yeah, through the entire investigation, I think that's something that we need, that you want, is to help to understand this and say, well, what's the connection? What was the link? And so we had every resource possible, and we worked that tirelessly, both from everything from his side, but all the victims and all the members of the house from their side. So we have never, to this date, found a single connection between him and any of the four victims or the two surviving roommates.
That was various questions from yesterday afternoon's press conference held in Boise at the Ada County Courthouse with investigators in the Brian Hoberger murder case. You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tie-dye-everything.com.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Ungadunga Brewing Company of 333 North Jackson Street in Moscow. Ungadunga features live music, special events, fine food, and craft beers at hungadungabrewing.com and on Facebook and Instagram.
The Idaho Conservation League and Save the South Fork Salmon filed a lawsuit in 4th District Court today alleging the Idaho Department of Environmental Quality failed to protect public health when it approved an air quality permit for the planned reopening of the 125-year-old Stibnite gold mine in the Payette National Forest, located near the border of the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness. Perpetua Resources, formerly Midas Gold, says it expects to mine $6 billion worth of gold, silver, and antimony during the 12 to 15 years of mining, which would occur after a three-year construction phase. The Payette National Forest issued a final record of decision to allow the mining to move forward January 3rd, although several more permits were required for mining operations to start, including the Idaho Department of Environmental Quality air permit. Will Tiedemann of the Idaho Conservation League issued a statement saying, Idaho DEQ's misleading analysis of arsenic emission and cancer risks could expose anyone who works or recreates near the mine to dangerous levels of toxic and carcinogenic pollution. We should be able to trust that agencies such as DEQ will protect the public instead of misleading us about public health risks. Judy Anderson of Save the South Fork Salmon said Idaho DEQ continues to cater to Perpetua Resources' attempts to bend the rules and disregard the risks from its proposed mine. Perpetua's disregard is particularly brutal given that its workers will be living at the mine site, forced to breathe toxic air day after day. Time and again, DEQ has been given an opportunity to protect public health from toxic air pollution as the law requires, and time and again, it has failed to do so. Perpetua Resources responded to the lawsuit in a statement which said the Stibnite Gold Project's air permit to construct underwent years of regulatory review, refinement, and rigorous science-based analysis. The project cleared the high bar set by the Department of Environmental Quality because Perpetua Resources clearly demonstrated to the agency and its board that the project meets or exceeds all requirements of state and federal law and that the project's emissions will be protective of human health and the environment. Development of an interconnected electric vehicle charging network along interstate highways passing through Idaho remains paused due to a February 6th budget freeze of the federal program that was financing the project. President Joe Biden signed the bill creating the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Formula Program, or NEVI, in 2021. The program provided federal guidance and compensation for the construction of electric vehicle charging stations every 50 miles along interstate highways. U.S. Transportation Department Office of Planning, Environment, and Realty Associate Administrator Emily Biondi said in her February 6th letter to program recipients, the Federal Highway Administration was immediately suspending the approval of all state electric vehicle infrastructure development plans for all fiscal years. The letter said, quote, therefore, effective immediately, no new obligations may occur under the NEVI formula program until the updated final NEVI formula program guidance is issued and new state plans are submitted and approved. The letter did say already active building that included contractual obligations with states may run to completion and the Highway Administration will compensate recipients for those projects. The Idaho Capital Sun reported the Idaho Interagency Working Group, consisting of officials from the Idaho Transportation Department, the Idaho Department of Environmental Quality, and the Idaho Office of Energy and Mineral Resources, has been waiting for further guidance since the federal government rescinded electric vehicle charging station funding in February. The Washington Senate Health and Long-Term Care Committee learned Tuesday the federal budget bill Congress passed July 3rd will have negative consequences for the state's health care system. Starting in 2026, policy changes combined with the possible expiration of enhanced advanced premium tax credits are expected to increase costs in the individual insurance market, pricing out at least 80,000 Washingtonians who get their private health care plans under the program during the first year. Under the budget law, called the Big Beautiful Bill, deep cuts to federal funding of Medicaid will strip between 200,000 and 320,000 low-income Washingtonians of their health insurance by 2027. The state is expected to lose billions of dollars in federal funding by 2034. Health outcomes for low-income residents are expected to also take a hit from cuts in federal funding for nutrition programs like SNAP. Governor Bob Ferguson said he has committed to filling the $11 million funding gap in federal funds if federal funds are successfully stripped from Planned Parenthood by the bill. Washington State Healthcare Authority Medicaid Director Dr. Charissa Fotinos described her review of the presentation given to lawmakers. Fotinos said, "As I was reviewing these slides and reading about it over the last few months, I will say, as a person and a primary care provider, it just hurts. It hurts to read these, and it's painful."
This Saturday is a national day of protest in response to the Trump administration's recently signed Big Beautiful Bill Act, which cuts funding for Medicaid, food assistance, and other programs. Hundreds of peaceful protests are planned across the country, including at least nine in Washington state. Liz Moore of the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane is organizing an event with local healthcare unions, highlighting how federal cuts will hurt healthcare access and rural hospitals.
This bill robs hospitals and clinics of funding, including rural hospitals, and makes our already tenuous healthcare system strain and probably break at the seams. It steals healthcare coverage from 16 million adults and children.
Republican Representative Michael Baumgartner of Spokane praised the Act's $50 billion allocation for rural healthcare, though the Act is expected to cut total rural health spending by $155 billion. In eastern Washington, over half the children rely on Apple Health, the state's Medicaid system. Moore calls the act a heist.
It really bankrolls massive tax giveaways for the ultra-rich and for greedy corporations at the same time that our communities are going to be hurt, and we say no.
Many may be feeling overwhelmed in the face of mass deportations or cuts to food aid across the country, Moore adds, but people need to keep pushing against these policies.
When we see that we're not alone, when there's somebody you know at the rally you didn't know was going to be there, those feelings can keep us in motion.
Rally locations can be found at mobilize.us/families first. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
We now have the last in our series of interviews with Pullman City Council candidates who are running in the crowded August 5th primaries in Ward 1 and Ward 3. This time it's an interview with Ward 3 City Council candidate Colin Bannister. In the August 5th primary, voters in Ward 1 will have a choice of seven candidates on the ballot for one of the seats representing the western part of the city, and there are eight candidates on the ballot for the Ward 3 seat representing the southern part of the city, although two of them have told KRFP they have dropped out of the race. The Ward 3 candidates who are running for the seat being vacated by Megan Guido, who is not running for re-election, are Carl Olson, Frederico Bartolo, Tony Zumlas, and Valerie Shea Ortega. Two other candidates, Michelle Jandy Utzman and Dave Gibney, have told KRFP they have dropped out of the race. The other Ward 3 council member is Pat Wright, who has 2 years remaining in her term. KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox spoke with Ward 3 candidate Colin Bannister this week.
I think one of the biggest reasons that's called me to city council recently is that I've seen a lot of instability with the city government. I've seen firsthand, just living on Main Street, the construction project there, and it went long over budget time-wise and money-wise, and that was startling to me. That really was clear to me that city government does impact your life, sometimes right outside your window. So, quite literally, I was being woken up to construction every morning at 4 a.m., and that really was a wake-up call for me, quite literally, that city council really does make a difference. And I've had a lot of experience working in the state legislature as a student lobbyist. I was on the WSU student government for 3 years, and also serve as the president of the Washington Student Association, which is our coalition of all the student governments in the state that are from public universities, lobbying on things like financial aid, campus safety, sexual assault prevention, a wide variety of issues impacting students here in Pullman and students across the state. And I got a lot of experience from the state legislature from that, learned how to ask questions, learned how to advocate for my community and my students. And I think that in Pullman, we need more of that. We need people that are willing to ask tough questions. We need people that work with everybody in the community and seek everybody in the community. And so some of my core values for running for city council is stronger city leadership and accountability, stronger student engagement, and stronger work with our state legislature as well.
What type of experience do you have with city government?
So I mentioned that I worked as a WSU student lobbyist at the state legislature, but I also collaborated with the Chamber of Commerce's legislative committee. I worked to coordinate with different members on city council about legislative priorities and different things like that. So that was really my main engagement and opportunities that I had working with city council and city government. But like I mentioned before as well, city government impacts us all directly or indirectly. And I think that sometimes we see things in our community and we don't always see the connection to city council, but really everything in our community is driven and fueled by the city government.
What is your definition of transparency in terms of decision making?
I think that when we think about transparency, we really think about easy public access. So if somebody has a question, they should be able to ask their city council member and get a good answer or a clear answer on what. Even if, you know, for a legal reason they can't give an answer, they should state, I can't give an answer because of this reason. But really what it looks like is easy access to the people that are making these decisions. It also looks like easy access on our government websites to meeting minutes, all those type of things, coordinating with media, talking with media about what's going on with city government. And I think in this new day and age where we're shifting more to social media, there needs to be more social media engagement with the city, because that really is how people get their news, their information, more and more. And the city needs to adapt to that and get more information out that way.
What is your definition of transparency in terms of decision making?
I think that when we think about transparency, we really think about easy public access. So if somebody has a question, they should be able to ask their city council member and get a good answer or a clear answer on what. Even if, you know, for a legal reason they can't give an answer, they should state, I can't give an answer because of this reason. But really what it looks like is easy access to the people that are making these decisions. It also looks like easy access on our government websites to meeting minutes, all those type of things, coordinating with media, talking with media about what's going on with city government. And I think in this new day and age where we're shifting more to social media, there needs to be more social media engagement with the city, because that really is how people get their news, their information, more and more. And the city needs to adapt to that and get more information out that way.
In light of the new Trump policies, including budget cuts and our international students not coming here at this time, and the closing down of rural hospitals, and the international students that are here, they're feeling concerned and scared about being racially profiled and perhaps disappeared. What role do you think that the Pullman City Council should have during these changing times and in addressing these serious concerns?
I think that City Council's goal really should be to serve the community, and I think that a lot of people in our communities are concerned about these issues. And while City Council is not the federal government, it's not the state government, there are some issues that city government just cannot make a huge impact or difference on. But we can connect people with casework. When people have an issue and they need access to help at the federal government or at the state government with something that they're facing, we can help provide those resources to people. We can provide information about what's going on and what the local community impacts are going to be of different policy changes. And really, I think one of the biggest things too is we just need to listen to people, because people are really scared in some of these situations. And working with them to figure out how we can make Pullman a safe space and a good place for them to be.
Okay. What are your thoughts on all the instability surrounding Pullman right now? Everything going on from the loss of our police chief, the stepping down of the Chamber of Commerce director, Marie Dymkowski, to the police chief snafu that occurred there, and Mike Urban's name coming into that, and then the firing of Mike Urban. What are your thoughts on all this instability surrounding downtown Pullman? And I'm wondering, is there a common denominator in all these things that possibly play a role?
I think the common denominator that a lot of people have is that people don't know what's going on, and that only contributes further to the instability and the rumors of instability. And I think that we need a city council that is, you know, asking the tough questions and not afraid to have tough conversations about these issues. Because I think sometimes with any government or board or commission, sometimes it's encouraged not to ask tough questions. It's encouraged to really show a unified slate. But when there's issues like these going on, we need people that are going to ask questions and have those difficult conversations. Because if they don't, then we're not going to know. And when we don't know, the rumors spiral and more issues come out of it. The other big takeaway I have from this too is that we're not focusing on big issues impacting Pullman, like how are we going to get more people in Pullman? How are we going to retain people in Pullman? Because we're stuck in these issues and this drama. So I really think that we need city council that is more forward-thinking and focused on the issues that matter.
Do you have any closing remarks?
Yeah, I think some of the big things that I want to talk about to wrap things up is kind of my plan if I'm on city council moving forward, what I'm really going to advocate for. I think that I've talked about city accountability and stronger leadership in that way, but also I think that we've seen a lack of that on some different issues, such as Main Street, for example. When the project was going over budget, over time, we didn't really have information on necessarily why that was, and I didn't see from city council questions on that in the public meetings. And I think that we need people that are asking questions when these projects come up and planning them out better beforehand. Mm-hmm. I think that a big goal of that project was getting more people to come to Main Street by making the sidewalks broader and improving the general infrastructure. But I think the issue is that people don't come because of the infrastructure. People come because there's things to do. And I think that we need to focus more on that, of how do we have events and reasons for people to come down to Main Street, less than how do we build the infrastructure to get them there. Because it's not a good investment when you have amazing infrastructure but nobody coming down. And the businesses were already hit so hard because of COVID, and then they were shut down for another almost year because of that construction project. And I just think that there could have been some things coordinated better with the businesses in that regard. And then the other part of that, too, I mentioned that people aren't coming down to Main Street as much, is that sometimes the university and the town can feel like separate towns. I think that we need people on city council that engage students more in the stuff that's going on, because they represent about half of the population of the city when they're here studying. So we need to do more work to engage those students and get them in the community, get them coming down to Main Street. And then in terms of also with the university, we have a lot of traffic from the football games. We have people coming in, and we need policies that incentivize that. And the recent Airbnb policies and short-term rental of basically making it much, much harder to hold those and to have Airbnbs and short-term rentals is going to decentivize that. It's going to decentivize people coming into Pullman, and they're going to end up going to towns like Palouse or Colfax or even Spokane if they want to. So I think that we need to focus on also getting more people into Pullman and keeping them here.
That was our interview with Pullman City Council Ward 3 candidate Colin Bannister. Bannister is one of eight candidates on the primary ballot for one of the Ward 3 Pullman City Council seats. Other candidates in the Ward 3 race are Carl Olson, Federico Bartolo, Tony Zumlas, and Shay Ortega. Two other candidates, Michelle Jandy Utzman and Dave Gibney, have told KRFP they have dropped out of the race. The candidates are running for the seat now held by Megan Guido, who is not running for re-election. The top two vote-getters in the August 5th primary will advance to the November general election. Well, that's it for the KRFP evening report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area, it'll be mostly clear through at least Tuesday with a low of 54 tonight. West winds 5 to 10, becoming light after midnight. Gusts up to 20. High 85 tomorrow. West winds 5 to 15. Gusts up to 20. Low 53 Friday night. West winds 10 to 15, becoming light after midnight. Gusts up to 25. High 82 Saturday. Low 52 Saturday night. West winds 5 to 10, becoming light in the evening. Gusts up to 20. And highs 83 Sunday, 90 on Monday, and 95 Tuesday and Wednesday. Lows will be 54 Sunday night and 59 Monday and Tuesday night. Currently 84 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners and know that your business or nonprofit supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. David Katz and Brenda Cox assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by listeners like you and by Giant Palouse Earthworm, providing DIY music booking in Moscow and Pullman. Focusing on extreme metal, punk, hardcore, and the avant-garde. Giant Blues Earthworm is available on Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube. Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Rembrandt Tree Care, family owned and operated since 1977. A conscientious approach to urban forestry with year-round tree service on the Palouse and surrounding areas. You can reach Rembrandt Tree Care at 509-330-0699.
KRFP thanks all of its donors and underwriters for helping make this programming possible.